Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with John N. Allen, MD, and Melissa Rubianes about factors that influence treatment decision-making in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Dr. Allen is an associate professor of clinical medicine and a member of the lymphoma faculty in the Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, as well as a member of the CLL Research Center at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York, New York. Rubianes is a hematology oncology physician assistant at Weill Cornell. In our exclusive interview, Allen and Rubianes discussed best practices for oncologists and PAs when it comes to collaborating with each other to make treatment decisions for patients with CLL, disease factors and patient characteristics that affect their treatment sequencing decisions, ongoing studies and emerging therapies for CLL that they're excited to see, and more.
Hi, I'm John Allen. I'm here at Cornell in New York City, and I'm an associate professor of clinical medicine in our Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology and a specialist in lymphoma and in CLL.
Hi, my name is Melissa Rubianes. I'm a physician assistant at Cornell. I've been practicing at Cornell for the past 8 years, and I'm specialized in lymphoma. So I work in clinic with Dr. Allen, and I usually see CLL patients and a whole broad range of lymphoma.
I think obviously CLL and any oncologic management is always a team effort, and there's a lot of moving parts and coordination that needs to occur. Having a tight-knit process with your physician extenders as well as, you know, the other components of the team are very important. Getting on the same page with your physician assistants is going to be important to understand who's going to take over what role regarding ordering or follow-up or management of some toxicities and what type of toxicities, when to escalate issues to you when the patient calls in with specific problems, and understanding that comfort level of everybody involved in managing these issues.
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Allen. It's really a team approach. And there are some situations where side effects happen after hours, and we need to coordinate and when to hold, when to dose reduce. So it is a team approach. And it's also important that we get to know our patients and really get to understand that when the symptoms become enough to that we need to make a change, that we actually do. So it's a big part of being in tune with the patients, being in tune with the providers, and all just having like an open communication loop where we can make the best decision for the patient.
As a specialist in the field, we get rather focused. And so it helps kind of stay up on kind of all of the state of the art changes and updates, approvals, press releases, all these kinds of things. Because when you're in that field, you know, information can start to come to you and flow to you rather easily. But obviously, it's very important to check out the major conferences throughout the year, whether it's ASCO, the European Summer Conferences, or ASH. Additionally, there's a lot of CME-directed conferences that are throughout the year that either I'm asked to participate in or I'll be invited to for a panel or something like that, where you can learn a lot from your colleagues. And so really, it's kind of an evolving dynamic process. And usually most of my information is coming from data releases at the conferences, not necessarily from published manuscripts, because usually the data releases already have happened at that point in time, as well as working with pharma partners as well, because they have different agendas and different thoughts, and they are aware of press releases, want to get opinions on things and how you view data releases. So they come and cycle back with you many times. And so that's how I'm getting most of my information. And try to stay kind of with a finger on the pulse of those releases as they're happening.
It is really helpful to work in an academic medical center where it's cutting edge and you're kind of, before major updates happen, you're kind of part of it. So that's a great part of working at Cornell. Also for PAs, there's a conference, APAO, that I go to every year. That's really helpful. And it has updates for PAs. It's all across oncology. It's not just CLL, but it's really helpful. And it gives PAs updates annually. So it kind of keeps you updated with the latest information. And I also use a lot of UpToDate on as far as like dose reduction and things like that. It has some really helpful resources.
The CLL patient is rather heterogeneous. The fortunate thing is most are actually relatively low risk and probably are going to do very well with one or two classes of drugs in their lifetime. But it is important to identify those higher risk patients. And that's where, you know, looking at our prognostic factors at diagnosis, at times of progression are important to see what has changed, because it is a heterogeneous population and it is a dynamic population too. So things evolve over time. And you need to really understand that. And if you do understand that, as we continue to have maturing data and certain subpopulations being evaluated with specific types of treatment approaches, we are learning that it's not necessarily one size fit all, that even with these targeted agents, that certain disease factors and biologic prognostic factors do potentially impact somebody's remission or how well they might do with the treatment. Many of those are still classic high-risk features. Unmutated IGHV, deletion 17P, complex karyotype is something that's newly evolving as something that might identify a patient at risk of even failing continuous therapy BTK inhibitors, maybe at a higher rate. So these things we look for, we want to identify them early. We do manage our patients slightly differently. We follow them closer, and you know, outside of clinical trials and things, sometimes if we see true disease activity, potentially even intervene with treatment in really high-risk patients before they kind of meet absolute treatment guidelines, because many times when you've gotten to that point, the disease burden is rather significant, and it can be more difficult to handle the patient at that point in time. I think Pirto is a great new agent that we have now at our disposal. It's FDA approved currently on an accelerated basis after a covalent BTK as well as a BCL2 inhibitor. Likely that will broaden as the full registrational approvals start to come in, where we are starting to see them throughout the world and are waiting for that in the US. With that said, it's an excellent drug. It has great pharmacokinetics in terms of its ability to maintain BTK inhibition throughout dosing intervals, as well as it's a very selective drug, so it is well tolerated. Right now, you know, we don't have a lot of data in the frontline setting, but I do think there is opportunity that this drug will displace other covalent BTK inhibitors. I still remain a little hesitant until we have a little bit longer term data to really understand what does mutational profiles look like, what does the resistant profiles look like, because we are learning that they are different between these drugs, covalents and non-covalents. And depending on that profile, it could potentially impair response to other BTK inhibitors. So I think that's one hesitancy that people have. Right now in our practice, you know, we typically are using it in patients who are, you know, double refractory, double exposed, people who have failed covalent BTK inhibitors, whether it's true intolerance or true resistance. And so I kind of am keeping it in the back pocket at this point in time, but I could see a time in the future, particularly the fixed duration approaches, if this drug shows that it is differentially effective in combination with other agents and or differentially more safe potentially too. Because I think in a fixed duration approach, you kind of eliminate some of these risks of resistance and long-term exposure that might render other covalent BTK inhibitors less useful. So I look forward to the data maturing. But right now we are kind of using it as kind of that rescue medicine in these patients who are progressing on our standard drugs right now.
I do think it is a really important thing to have a thorough patient history before, especially starting a BTK inhibitor. So do they have high blood pressure? Do they have any cardiac comorbidities, history of AFib? Were they hospitalized with RVR and uncontrollable AFib? Things like that, where it's important to know the side effects of the drugs and that this is very real. The good thing about pirtobrutinib is that because it's highly selective, it has a safer side effect profile, and these are not as much as an issue as the earlier generation BTK inhibitors. So it's exciting and it's hopeful for the future. But I think the patient history is the most important thing that you can do, and getting a really thorough history for before you start any of these medications. As of recent, we're doing more fixed duration treatments involving BTK inhibitors instead of them being permanently on it. It's basically for a limited period and then they're off of it. And it's usually in combination with other treatments for CLL, like venetoclax and obinutuzumab. But it is exciting that this can actually be something in the future that's going to be fixed duration and not going to be a permanent medication that these patients need to take for the rest of their lives. So I think it's specifically for BTK inhibitors, that's really exciting. And we're doing it, you know, in clinical trials at Cornell. So it's exciting to see it firsthand.
A lot of the research in the frontline setting is how to optimize these drugs. We know that they are safely combined. We know they're very effective when they're combined. It's now the research is going into how do we maximize an outcome and minimize toxicity and identify the right patient population for a specific treatment approach. So we have certain studies that are potentially going to help address some of that. CLL17 that looks at ibrutinib versus ibrutinib venetoclax versus venetoclax obinutuzumab. Some other response adapted studies like the MAGIC trial that's looking at acalabrutinib venetoclax versus venetoclax obinutuzumab in a response adapted approach. So I think looking at these various strategies and then also how to response adapt our patients in order to maximize that outcome is kind of where the future is, at least in the frontline setting. But I think in the relapse setting and kind of the new drug development, there's a few things that are out there. Obviously, some of the pirtobrutinib combinations with BCL2 inhibitors, as well as some newer agents in the BCL2 class like sonrotoclax. We also have some exciting data emerging with BTK degraders that are new class of drugs that will help address resistance to not only covalent, but non-covalent, and are showing some promising early phase 1 now kind of phase 2 expansion data that we're starting to get into. It's a great class of drugs and it's a unique mechanism of action. And that's the nice thing in CLL is that when we've developed new drugs, that it really targets the resistant mechanism that is at play. And so this is another example of that, whereas the first example is a non-covalent BTK inhibitor addressing CYS41S mutations. And now we've got BTK degraders that might address some of these new resistant mutations like kinase dead mutations and gatekeeper mutations that we're seeing in the presence of non-covalence. And then, you know, our immunotherapeutic approaches, we shouldn't forget those, you know, CAR T-cell, bispecifics, those are also going to be important. And how do we combine these together to maximize our outcomes is going to be important and nice areas for future research.
It's really important to monitor these side effects, especially once the patient starts the medication. Like, are you having any rashes? Are you having any procedures where you would need to hold the drug in order to minimize bleeding risk? So especially, are they on a blood thinner already? Because that can also increase the bleeding risk. Do you need to hold it potentially for procedures? Things like that are really important. So that all influences us starting this medication and also will make us more alert for monitoring symptoms.
I echo a lot of those comments. I mean, I think we can quickly brush over con meds and medical history and kind of forget about that MI that the patient may have had 5 years ago and not fully understand why they might be on a blood thinner. So understanding that patient as a whole is obviously important, but from a CLL perspective, I think it is important to understand prognostics. It really helps predict that biology for the future. It helps educate the patient of what to expect, as well as for you and when you might need to intervene and who is at high risk, who's at low risk. And so it really can unveil itself and really lead to a lot of nice education for the patient and lead to realistic expectations and help alleviate some of the fear. And then obviously another component is just to manage some of the issues that we deal with the CLL and the patient, infection, vaccinations, how to manage infections with antibiotics while you're on these specific drugs like COVID and you know some of these agents that we use. So educating yourself a little bit on how these drugs might interact, drug-drug interactions, is also going to be an important component of managing and optimizing those outcomes for our patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at Enclave. On Facebook, like us at Enclave, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.